Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, places, stories, and events in our central Iowa community. I am Mike Metz, your host for this hour, along with engineer, magic music man Michael Murphy, and Pat Schlierbaum, Milford Township's resident naturalist and good neighbor. Anna Magnuson, alias Anna Banana, will share her heart-to-heart and tune in Tuesday's messages later this hour. For you cryptologists out there, there's a hidden message related to the vaccines and that terrible coronavirus we're all dealing with these days. Dr. Molly Lee, Associate Director of the Center for Food Security Public Health at Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine, is with us today. Hello, Molly.
Good morning, Mike.
It's been about a month, I think, since our last visit. What updates with respect to the COVID-19 pandemic do you have to share with us today?
Yeah, happy to do that. So kind of to just run through where we're at as a whole, U.S. cases have fallen since last month. Those are kind of the numbers that are in the news, but are somewhat plateauing. So our country is still reporting over 65,000 cases per day on average, which is similar to the peak of the surge last summer. And happily, death rates have also fallen since last month, down to about 2,000 deaths per day nationwide, compared to about 3,000 a day when I was on last month. So while we certainly rejoice every decrease in cases and every fall in death rates, I just kind of want to highlight this pandemic is still very much present. Those 2,000 people or somebody's family member or friends. So it's good to celebrate the decreases, but not time to whip off your masks and go congregate in large groups quite yet.
Yes, we
in Iowa.
I was going to say, go ahead. We certainly don't want to let our guard down just because we've had a certain drop, because we've seen this before and it can rise again, right?
Exactly. Yep. It's kind of a matter of perspective. So
go ahead.
in Iowa in the past month, we've lost about an additional 500 people to this virus. In our county total, we've lost about 45 people. So then on to the good news again, our positivity rate continues to trend downwards. So currently at our county, this is at less than 4.2%. It's been below 5% for the past 2 weeks. So that's good news. Iowa State University's weekly positivity rate is 3.3%. And Story County schools do continue to have occasional cases, which vary by district and building. But absenteeism due to illness has generally remained less than 3.5%.
Okay, so how are distribution efforts for the vaccine faring these days?
Yeah, so vaccine allocations, which we get that from our state. I apologize, my dog is barking in the background. The allocations from IDPH have held steady for the past few weeks. Can you hear me okay, Mike?
Yes, I can hear you. Every good veterinarian has a pet in the house. So do folks that just love animals.
Yep, and there are animals outside, and that's what she's rejoicing about, I guess. So if folks are keeping track of the numbers on the Story County Public Health webpage, they might look a little different, because the sixth dose available in the vial for the Pfizer vaccine is now officially being included in the dose count. And so this week, Story County Public Health has been allocated about 1,200 prime doses. So of these, about 200 will be used in clinics put on by Story County Public Health for the Tier 1 group, so that's school staff and first responders. And the remainder will be distributed to healthcare providers in our county for people age 65 and older. And Iowa State will begin receiving some vaccines to vaccinate campus daycare providers too, who are covered under Tier 1.
Okay, that's great. Whereabouts are we at in the 1B? Are you aware as far as the age level for the primary target, with, of course, a few exceptions? Do you know about where we're sitting at right now?
Yeah, so it varies a little bit by the particular healthcare provider. And so that information isn't public except for McFarland Clinic, which is our largest healthcare provider in the county. And I believe that right now, I think that they are working on ages 74 to 88 or somewhere in that range.
Okay.
So most of the medical providers in our county are working backwards from oldest to youngest. And so that's kind of where they're at.
Sure.
Right now.
And I know there are cases where if a somebody were to, say, get an earlier appointment and then they release their former appointment, sometimes others are able to take advantage of that right away.
Yeah. So how all the medical clinics in our county are working it, again, is a little bit different. Some of the clinics are calling their patients, and so you can wait for a phone call. You can also contact any of the medical clinics, whether or not you're a patient there, and directly see what their protocols are. And then there's also the pharmacies in our area. So a lot of folks have been having success getting a vaccine at pharmacies, because of those, of course, are not able to work, you know, they don't have patients, so they're not working oldest to youngest. So if you can get a vaccine, even outside of your normal healthcare provider, go ahead and get that. That's what we encourage you to do. And we can work out who is next on the list, and that can open up a spot for someone else.
Sure. Do you have any feel for the idea that our Secretary of Ag, our former Governor Vilsack, has proposed veterinarians using more staff in the Department of Ag for distribution of the vaccine? Have you heard anything about that?
Yeah, I am not super up to date on the recent status of that. I know that in some other states, veterinarians have been approved to help with administration of the vaccine. The key thing is you want someone trained in administering vaccines and where to give it appropriately to minimize any potential damage to different areas, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so veterinarians, of course, give vaccines every day. There are other healthcare professionals that are being considered as well, dentists, folks like that. And so really when our vaccine supply starts to increase a lot, like we hope and think it is in the coming weeks, having people to get shots into arms will be really important for the health of our community. And so I think that would be great if we could get additional people helping to administer vaccines.
Well, I can't agree with you more. You know, there's an old saying that MDs know the humans, one species, whereas the veterinarians have to know all the rest of the species. So that
exactly.
was always kind
yeah,
of
we
a
have,
humor.
Have T-shirts that we sell in vet school saying that.
So. Yeah, yeah.
kind of pride.
A question I have for you is what is the difference between the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that was just approved a couple of days ago for use, that and the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines? Some of the differences.
Yeah, so the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, which of course are the two that have been used thus far for vaccination, are what are called mRNA vaccines. So that's a relatively new technology. And then the Johnson & Johnson vaccine uses kind of a more traditional vaccine technology that's used for a lot of other vaccines other than the coronavirus vaccine. And how that works is the coronavirus kind of has these things on them called spike proteins mm-hmm. that it uses to enter the human cells. And so the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines have instructions to target that spike protein. How they differ is that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, store those instructions somewhere different than the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, that gene is stored in a vector. So it's an adenovirus vector, and that's a common vector that usually causes cold, flu-like symptoms, things like that. And so the J&J vaccine uses a modified adenovirus that can enter cells, but it can't replicate inside them or cause illness. So all of the vaccines, they can't enter or change your nucleus or your DNA, anything like that, but they use a little bit of different technology.
So it's really the primary difference seems to be the way that it's delivered, its delivery system.
Exactly.
Using something that's more traditional, which is what Johnson & Johnson, that was their track for development, whereas the mRNA is newer, but it's well-tested because it's been used in some of the other problems in the past. I can think of HIV for one and some of the early SARS infections. Is that correct?
Yeah, so mRNA vaccine in the use that it's being right now is the first. So it's the first mRNA vaccine is the SARS coronavirus 2 vaccine. But the technology, isn't brand new. It's been tested and used in the medical field for a while. So it's not quite as new as it sounds. The other big difference between the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines is that the Johnson & Johnson only requires one dose. So that's not something, how the vaccine works and how many doses isn't really something the average consumer needs to be super concerned about, although it's good to be informed. Mm-hmm. Really, where this is going to be very helpful is in rural areas, even overseas in, middle and low income countries where distribution can be a really big problem. Having just one vaccine will be very helpful logistically. And so even in our community, that can be helpful for some of our harder to reach populations.
And if you could just review the point that it doesn't really matter which of these approved vaccines. If you get vaccinated, you are protected and you are helping with the population itself as far as the effectiveness of these vaccines. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah, you should. We encourage everybody to take whatever vaccine is offered and available to them. Some might have concerns over what they hear in comparison is lower efficacy for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. You know, in the it's 66% and I think 72 or 74% in the U.S. efficacy for the J&J vaccine, whereas Pfizer and Moderna just kind of blew it out of the water with about 95% efficacy. These are both still very good vaccines. And the important point is they have similar efficacy rates for preventing hospitalization and death and severe disease. So all of these vaccines are very good. And we really encourage everyone to get a vaccine and get whichever is available to them.
Okay. Is there anything else, Molly, that you would like to add before we leave today?
Yeah. So I just wanted to, again, can't emphasize enough that these vaccines are safe, they're effective, they're increasing in their availability. And as you said, Mike, the more folks that are vaccinated, the more that life will return to the normal we knew before COVID. So for those who wish to get a vaccine, who are eligible right now, that's folks greater than 65. The Story County Public Health COVID-19 vaccine information page, which is housed on the Mary Greeley website, has all of the information you need as far as contact numbers for local clinics and pharmacies and how you can go about getting a vaccine.
Okay. Thank you, Molly. And we look forward to our visit next month.
Thank you.
And staying in the same facility, I want to welcome Dr. Karen Harmon, Clinical Associate Professor of Veterinary Diagnostic and Production Animal Medicine at Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine's Diagnostic Lab. Gosh, Karen, that's a mouthful. You're joining us to share some info about the PCR testing.
Thank you, Mike, and thanks for including me in your program today.
Yes. Karen, can you briefly describe your role with the diagnostic laboratory as it relates to animal health using the PCR testing?
Sure. I've been at the Vet Diagnostic Lab at Iowa State since 1997, so a little bit over 24 years. And my role when I started there was to bring on PCR testing. I think a lot of your listeners have probably heard this term, especially with regard to COVID testing. Prior to my employment at the university, they were not doing any of that type of testing. So I've been responsible with, other people in the group. I'm not, certainly not taking credit by myself for bringing on a variety of PCR tests for different viruses and bacteria that can affect animal health. So it was a little bit slow taking off, but after the veterinarians realized the usefulness and the speed and the accuracy of the testing, it has become a very major part of the work that is done at the diagnostic lab.
Yes, I would agree with you there. Can you just discuss a little bit about the sensitivity and maybe specificity of this test related to some of the older methods? Is it a pretty reliable?
It is very reliable. PCR stands for polymerase chain reaction, and it is based on differences in the genetic material or DNA of an organism. As I think most people realize, DNA is kind of the blueprint for a particular organism and gives it all of its qualities and its identity. And because of differences in DNA sequences between different organisms, you can use that to your advantage to develop very, very specific tests for different bacteria and viruses. So it's a very rapid test. And because you're getting down to the genetic level, you can usually gear the test to make it extremely specific. And that's been a real advantage when you're trying to identify viruses that might be closely related, and you can zero in on those differences in the DNA to make the test as specific as it needs to be.
Now, what you're zeroing in on, I assume, is part of that genetic code, and there's not to get into the weeds too far, but there are some areas of that code that are what are called really conservative pieces, and is that what you're looking at?
Exactly, Mike. We're testing for rabies virus, you would want to have your test target a region of the rabies genome that is present in all rabies viruses, or as close to all as you can get. No test is going to be 100% accurate, but you want it to be very highly conserved among all rabies viruses, but it would be a portion of DNA or a sequence of DNA that is not present in any other virus or bacterial agent. So that's where you get your specificity.
Okay. How many animals? You're working in a vet facility. You're testing animals for herd health, more or less. How many do you test, say, on a given week? Or what's your annual number? Do you have a handle on that you can share?
I do. When we first started doing PCR, I don't have data for the very early years, but I can tell you in 2005, we did about 50,000 PCR tests over the course of the year. Last year, we were just over 500,000 PCR tests.
So,
and you have to remember that is not necessarily a reflection of how many animals are being tested, because a lot of practitioners request that samples be done on pooled serum samples. Typically, they would want 5 serum samples per pool. So that 500,000 tests that we did last year is a vast underrepresentation of the number of animals that we're testing, because there would be a significant number of those that would have been from pooled samples.
So when you're referring to a pooled sample, what you're talking about is taking samples from, say, 5 animals, putting them together, and then if there's a positive in that, you go back to those 5 to isolate?
Sometimes the client wants that, especially if the result is not expected to be positive and we return a positive result, they will frequently want us to go back to the individual samples. Clients also do a lot of PCR testing just to establish and maintain herd health. So if they're expected to be negative, often they will request pooled samples just to be able to test a larger number of animals at a lower cost. And if those are all negative, which they're hoping for, that gives them the peace of mind that, yes, this particular virus is not showing up in my herd.
Gosh, that seems like the animal industry, you're doing surveillance and monitoring, seem to be really on top of the health situation for those critters.
Yes, we have veterinarians or clients of veterinarians that submit on a regular basis for a number of viruses that could be pretty detrimental to especially the swine industry. So they're doing their due diligence to test on a routine basis to make sure that those animals are remaining healthy.
I may have stepped on you as you were trying to finish a thought. Can you pick back up on that, or should we go on?
I don't remember what that was,
okay.
Mike.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I think I was just going to make the point that we do get samples from clients who do have animals who are showing clinical signs of illness, but we also do a lot of testing just for maintaining health status. So we see both ends of the spectrum.
Okay. So in your early days of testing, you were maybe doing a handful compared to what you're doing now. How is that possible?
We are, most days now, we're doing thousands of samples a day. And a lot of that has become because of changes in technology. We used to have to test single samples at a time, and now we have the capability of doing tests in roughly 100 samples at a time. I mean, all of those results are individual, but the technology for PCR testing has improved and just skyrocketed over the time that I've been at the lab to allow us to be able to do very high numbers of sample testing for the most part, at least for our most urgent and most critical agents that we test. Clients get results the same day. So if we get the result, we used to have a cutoff of 11 or 11:30, and that keeps getting pushed later and later. And we've changed staffing times, you know, for our more shift type basis. So we have people there until 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and mm-hmm. that has all allowed us to be able to extend the workday to get those results out to the client. But PCR is a very rapid test. We can get results from a sample within 2 to 3 hours.
Boy, that's phenomenal, the turnaround on something like that. So let's shift gears a little bit. You've been working with the animal health for quite a while. How did you get involved with human PCR?
Yes, this has been a year like no other for everybody, but we felt that acutely. When it became apparent that COVID was going to make its way into the United States, I started doing some searching online and actually found some PCR protocols that were put out by the Center for Disease Control, giving very specific instructions for how to test for the COVID virus. And very naively, I and I know some others in our lab thought, oh, we need to be prepared to test for this because our clients are going to ask whether their animals have this virus. So I got the materials that would be necessary for it, and we validated to the extent possible. Of course, at that time, we didn't have any actual positive samples to base it on, but we have other ways that we can at least partially validate tests, and we did as much as we could with the information from the CDC to have a test available in case clients would be requesting that for animals. And then as time went on and this virus started showing up in the U.S., we started getting asked whether we would be able to do testing on humans, which we had never done before. Mm-hmm. And our first approach was instead to work with the state hygienic lab, the public health lab over in Iowa City, to help them be able to increase their testing potential. They had been doing PCR in their laboratory for years, but on much, much smaller number of samples.
Sure, because they'd be working with humans as opposed to herds of animals, individuals they'd be working with.
So over the course of several weeks to maybe a couple months, we worked with that laboratory. We sent personnel over. We sent equipment over. We sent reagents, we sent everything that would be necessary to do the testing as we have been performing it in our lab to get them transitioned to a high throughput testing system. So that increased their capacity from maybe, you know, several hundred to 1,000 a day to, I think I remember hearing them say at the peak of this, they were doing 10,000 tests a day. Hmm.
So how many human tests are you involved in a day, samples?
So we, as time went on, we were involved in conversations, and eventually we started doing the testing. We got the CLIA and HIPAA clearance and everything. And we, last year, we did around 50,000 PCR tests for COVID. We're doing testing through Iowa State, as well as some of the Iowa healthcare systems. It's definitely tapered off this year. Our biggest testing time was when the students were moving back to Iowa State. All of the students going back into student housing were required to be tested. Those days we were doing, maybe 3,000 to 4,000 tests. over the course of the week. So still not as much as we're doing with animal testing, but it was still, you know, it caused us to have to make some changes in personnel and shifts. It's definitely tapered off this year. Right now we're doing between 1,000 and 1,500 samples a week.
So it's still a significant amount of increase for the laboratory.
It is.
Now, are you? Have you been able to take somewhat of a break now that it's shifted to the downward a little bit, or how are your folks handling this in addition to their regular duties?
Well, we have about 20 people in our lab who are certified to do the testing. So they rotate through. I mean, it's part of a regular shift for some of the people during the week. And then we have people who rotate through weekend shifts. Primarily, that is just Saturdays. And we've actually done some Saturday testing for years. So that's not a new thing. During the peak of this with the students and also the athletic testing at Iowa State, we did have some times when people would have to go in and work on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
But usually it was, as far as the weekends, it would just be Saturday testing.
Okay.
I feel like having been trained and having been used to doing such high numbers of animal testing with short turnaround time, that just set us up to be able to do this. So there's definitely been some adjustments, but our staff have definitely stepped up. And I think all of them have felt very, very good about being able to be part of this whole situation to help Iowa State and the state of Iowa. We couldn't have done this without support from our administration and the attitude of our staff that they just wanted to do what was right and do it well.
Well, I know in my former career, I worked in that same laboratory, and I just want to thank you all for the dedication. I know I speak for a lot of the public. The dedication and the idea, the ethics behind that. Please pass on our thanks to the group. Is there anything you'd like to add before we close?
Just to reiterate that we have found it very rewarding. You know, during this time of confusion and panic, it felt good to be able to do something in the right direction to help, as I said, Iowa State, but, you know, more broadly, the state of Iowa. So I think we all felt that it was a very rewarding opportunity, and we were glad to be able to do it.
Thank you, Karen. And sometime I hope you maybe will come back and visit with us again. So enjoy your day. And
thank you, Mike.
Thanks again for
asking me to participate.
This has been a great
experience.
Very good. We're going to take a quick music break here and then go on to our next individual.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. I say, it's all right. Little darling, it's
Well, and speaking of the sun, I want to welcome Susan Guiazda from the city of Ames. Hello, Susan.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Yeah, I couldn't help but play something like that today. It's just the last couple days, it's really getting bright, isn't it?
It is getting bright, and the temperatures look great this week, so I hope people will get outside and enjoy all our Ames parks and trails, get your bike out. It's really going to be some nice weather, and we're really fortunate in Ames to have so many recreational opportunities, which explains the next guest I brought in, Parks and Recreation Director Keith Abraham. I overheard yesterday in our office that he wins the prize for the most big projects. I think they said he's got at least five he's juggling right now. And I can't even name all five, so I figured he could shed some light on all of those.
Oh, that's great. Hello, Keith. How are you doing today?
I am doing great, and I do love the music as well.
Oh, great.
That was a good selection.
Well, I know it's a little cool yet, but in fact, I see ice on Ada Hayden. The waterfall are still working, but I know the Aquatic Center is one of the projects that you're involved in.
Yeah. Well, the Furman, are you talking the Indoor Aquatic Center?
The Indoor Aquatic Center right now.
Yep. So the Indoor Aquatic Center, and I could lump in the Downtown Plaza with that as well. You know, two projects that were part of the Reinvestment District application that City Council last week, Tuesday, did direct staff to go ahead and submit that application. So that application has been submitted. It was put in on Thursday. And the request from the Iowa Economic Development Authority was for approximately $21 million, which would help fund the Aquatic Center. Now, there's been, I think there are 10 applications that were submitted for a total request of $201 million, but there's only $100 million that the authority is going to be doling out. So hopefully we'll get some chunk of money, and then council can decide where we're going to move from, or go from there with the Aquatic Center.
Okay, so that's step one in the progression of where we're going to be at. So it sounds like we'll be visiting with you in the future on that.
Yes, very much so.
Okay.
Yeah. And
let's go to the plaza.
The Downtown Plaza is that will be funded separate. You know, we're not looking for a tax rebate from the Reinvestment District program to do that project. We're looking probably this next year doing design and hopefully construction in 2022 for that.
Okay. And for those listeners who aren't familiar, where's the site for that?
Yeah, so the Downtown Plaza is going to be located in the parking lot directly east of City Hall. Flanked to the west by Clark Avenue, and then on the south, 5th Street and 6th Street on the north. So it's just about an acre of land, and looking at year-round activities, there'll be water feature in the summertime, some ice skating in the wintertime, there'll be restroom, there'll be areas, you know, just for passive recreation. People want to grab lunch. There'll be opportunities for food trucks, you know, to be involved there, you know, over lunch hour and for special events. So very exciting project that will be coming up.
Okay, let's stick with the outdoors a little bit. Are there some other park facilities that you're working on right now?
Yeah, well, one of the five so we got two down.
Okay.
Three to go, but one of the ones that I believe Susan was referencing is Splash Pad. Currently we do have a wading pool at Brookside Park, and it's not really what people are looking for, you know, anymore. It does serve a population, but a splash pad is flat. There is no standing water, and has a lot of different water features. Probably on the large side, a dump bucket, but in the meantime, it could be like a water mushroom, it could be spray cannons, it could be just water ground features, spray features, and so on. So we're looking at getting out a request for proposal for design here in the next week or so. And we'll be having some public meetings to get some input. The number of sites or locations, you know, that we can go to are limited because you do have to have a restroom nearby. And we do want to put this out of the floodplain. So it's really two locations we're looking at is Emma McCarthy Lee Park and Daly Park are the two that that we're looking at.
So on those hot days, it sounds like you might have an option to either get spritzed or really splashed on something like this, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah. And it's and one of the things that we're looking at, the two locations that I gave you is out west. One of the things that we're trying to do is as we put in these new amenities is really trying to make sure that we're putting amenities throughout the city and not really congregating them all into one area or one section of town. So this will be a nice addition. And you're right. It'll be in those hot days. It'll be great. And the thing with it is we won't have to staff it. What we will be doing is it'll be a recirculation system, so it'll operate similar to like a pool.
Okay.
So we will have to add chemicals and so on, but that and it'll all be done by activation switches. So we'll have it on a timer and say that it could be used from let's just say 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. And any time during those hours, somebody could come up, push a button, and that would activate all the features to start going.
Okay, so there's some user involvement here, some tactile contacts and things. That's great.
Yeah, and I think the other thing to mention with it too is this is a very it will be a very accessible, inclusive type of amenity within the park system. Whether you're able-bodied or have a disability or utilizing a mobility device, you'll be able to come and participate at this amenity.
And it sounds like as you're spreading some of these new areas into various, it's kind of a neighborhood thing almost, where people can get to it without having to drive long distances, for example.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay,
but it will be a feature. It will be a feature that people from throughout the community will want to go to.
Sure. So yeah. You've got another park that we haven't talked about yet that you're working on.
are you going to give me a little more hint?
I don't know. Or were those two the two parks?
So we have that. We have thing. So with the city council, with once they adopt the budget. The budget next week. There are a couple of other things. One other project is we're looking for. Have you ever seen I forget what the name of it is now, but like the ninja course, the thing on American Ninja Warriors. So we're actually looking at doing a playground, you know, similar to that. We would have some different features. That we would be able to, it would be a great fitness opportunity for individuals to go out there and just do a number of different things, lower body, upper body, climbing, running, those types of activities. So we're looking to do that in the park system.
Keith,
we haven't picked a location yet.
Yeah, when you're talking, well, it would have to have a sewer system and have to have lots of turtles, wouldn't it? You've got young friends.
Yeah, I didn't mention Ninja Turtles, but it is like a playground, but we'll also be able to. It will open up some programming opportunities for us because we'll be able to have classes, maybe do things with some of the younger youth, you know, middle school, high school, even elementary age school youth, and do some programming and help them develop some of their just their physical attributes as they go through. The other project. That the council has directed us to look at is what's called a soccer mini pitch. It's what it is a lot of times communities will put These on a parking lot or a tennis court, you know, something along those lines. But we'll be meeting with the AIM Soccer Club representatives, and we need to go back with council with a recommendation. But that's something that we'll be looking at doing, you know, probably within this next year as well. And we probably are not going to use tennis courts or a parking lot for it. We will probably, you know, pour a section of asphalt or concrete and then, you know, put this on. And basically what is it is it's a small surfaced type of area. It has fences, but you can do 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 5-on-5 soccer. And that will be another great addition. And again, we'll try to put that in a location within the park system that's maybe a little underutilized.
Okay. Yeah, you speak of some underutilized areas. Are there some parks that you just want to highlight before we go to your last project as far as letting the public know that, hey, you've got this park here and we don't see a lot of use?
Yeah, well, it's some of our smaller neighborhood parks, you know, are like that, don't necessarily get a ton of use. But one of the things that we have been really trying to encourage people over this past year is to go out and try to find and encourage people to go and look at some of the different parks. You know, from a walking standpoint, a lot of people love to go up to Ada Hayden. Moore Memorial Park has a great series of trails, asphalt trails through that park. If you're looking for something different, I would encourage people to go up there and give that a try. If you're looking at something a little bit more nature-esque, then East River Valley. You can access that off of Meadow Lane by the car park. There's a bridge that goes over the Skunk River, and then that takes you to a lot of grass trails as well. Greenbrier Park is a park on South 16th Street, just east of University, that doesn't get a lot of use, but it's a very nice park. Playground equipment, some green space access. It's right on the bike trail. Couple of parks that we're going to be finishing up some activities on this here, hopefully this spring, early summer, is Franklin Park, which is on Franklin Avenue, just south of Lincoln Way. And we'll be putting a shelter in there, and we're going to be moving the swings and then doing a border around the playground and so on. So we'll be adding a shelter to that. That will happen here, like I said, in the next few months. And then Hira Park, which is the old Edwards School site. With that, that's almost a 6-acre location. A lot of playground equipment already there, but we'll be adding a shelter and a basketball pad and, you know, some trails, you know, through there as well. So those are a couple of additional parks that hopefully people will start going to, and those will be getting more use. Obviously, Sunset Ridge, we just opened up that late last year. So.
Okay. I'm left-handed, and the coach would always put me in when he wanted to throw a curveball to a right-handed batter sometimes. So I'm going to throw one to you. Is there any work being done for East River Valley down along the river there? Yeah, I know at one time there was a low-head dam we were looking at.
Yeah. Yeah, and that project has been finished. It's modifications to the Lowhead Dam, part of River Valley Park. It's north of the softball diamonds, you know, that we have. But it's really neat. If you haven't been down there, we are going to be doing a ribbon cutting dedication on May 1st, okay, at roughly 10 a.m. And with that, it's if you're looking, if you're upstream of the river and you're looking downstream, river left would be on your left. And there will be there's a couple of different pools that are on river left, and will provide opportunities for canoers, kayakers, tubers, in certain flows. There'll be some whitewater situations. But then on River Right, there are additional smaller pools that will allow for fish passage up in and below the dam. So that project is complete, and you know we're still waiting for grass to start growing. Yeah. And then that's an area too that in the future with our capital improvement plan, we will be adding a new shelter, some additional parking, and new playground, you know, back there in that area. So stay tuned for those in the next several years.
Okay, and so now we're going to return home to Homewood Golf Course to wrap up. What have you got there?
You know, you're doing really well with these because, you know, it's all on my list of things to talk about. And we won't get to everything that's on my list, but Homewood Clubhouse, we have been working on that construction. That is coming along really nicely. All the windows are in. They're drywalling, you know, the inside right now. That will take several days. They're going to start working on the outside. So there will be some limestone that will be put on the front side, the entrance. There'll be some cedar on the front side. There'll be some vinyl siding that will go up on a couple of the sides. Have some concrete work to do. And a couple of our staff, Kelly and Nate, have been working hard to get all of the fixtures and furniture and other equipment. Seems like every day I'm seeing something, whether it's a projector, a hot dog roller, something that's coming in that we'll be putting into it. But our hope is that we have a meeting actually tomorrow afternoon, but we're hoping still for an April 1st opening of the course. We'll open on April 1st, and then we're also hoping that the clubhouse will open at that time as well. And then just one last project.
Keith, now, yeah. It's April 1st. Is that real or is that a joke?
you know, that thought has crossed my mind a couple of times when I look at that date. We hope it's not an April Fool's joke.
Okay.
We hope that is actually when we'll be able to open. But one of the other projects that's going on at Homewood is a long hole number 4. There's the ravine or the hillside that goes down to the Skunk River. There were some erosion issues, so they've been doing a lot of work on that, kind of scaling back the hillside. So right now, you know, there's if you've been relying on those trees along the left side of the fairway to kick your ball back into the fairway when you hook a shot or slice it, in your case, if you're a lefty, some of those trees are gone, so you're going to have to get a little better with your game right there. But that also should be done, you know, prior to us opening the course.
Okay. Well, Keith, we've got to leave you. Susan, is there anything that you need to add? Keith, any last words?
I guess my last words would be with the nice weather, and even if it's not so nice, still encourage people to get outside, explore different parks. You can go to our website. We have 38 parks. They all offer something a little different. Or even if it's just walking in your neighborhood, get outside, get active. After the long winter that we've had with the snow and the cold, start getting out there and soaking up that sunshine and improve your overall outlook on life, I guess, when you get outside and do something active.
Definitely gives you emotional and mental health. That, you know, that's something that a lot of people don't think about when you, well, some of us do, but it's becoming more of a concern. And boy, that sure helps lift my spirits every day. So thank you, Keith. Thank you, Susan. We'll see you again.
All right. Thanks for having us. Take care.
Daylight come and me wan go home. Work all night and a drink of rum.
Daylight come and we want to go home.
Stack banana till the morning come.
Daylight come and we want
to go. Well, Anna, alias Banana Magnuson, is joining us. And Anna, I hate to tell you this, but the banana split is going to have to be split even smaller because we've only got about 5 minutes left.
We got this. But what I love at KHOI is we welcome all voices of our community, regardless of their perspectives, to freely discuss issues fostering local pride and respect. And you guys certainly did that on Local Talk, including Nova, Susan's dog, made an appearance, and Molly's dog, too. So even voices that bark, we welcome on community radio.
Yeah. Well, you know, usually we wait till the dog days of summer, but we'll take it this year.
Exactly. Well, it is Tuesday, as I try and tempt you to listen to KHOI. So I'm going to start with a poem. It's called Loading Mercury with a Pitchfork. Loading mercury with a pitchfork. Your truck is almost full. The neighbors take a certain pride in you. They stand around watching. All right, so why a poem with a pitchfork? Well, because the dynamic duo for the Donna Lana Kitchen Show will be talking about pitchforks, soil, starting seeds, and compost. And again, the Donna Lana Kitchen Show talks about food, farming, recipes, advice, and opinions at noon today and repeated at 7 p.m. So, Mike Metz, you won't be talking about mercury, but here are a couple stanzas of a poem in honor of you, Sam Wormley, and Science Bite. The planet's red and very dead. Its air so thin, it's barely there. The nights are cold, and so's the day. Yet howling storms sometimes unfold and blow the dust away. So why would I read a poem about this particular planet,
Mike? Because you're thinking of a candy bar.
Oh, okay.
A Mars bar. We're going to, Sam Wormley and I are going to be joined by Mary Richards, and we're going to have a discussion as a follow-up to the successful landing of Perseverance on Mars.
No, I was talking about chocolate. Okay.
Oh.
all right. So I was wrong about that. All right. And again, when can you tune in to listen to you, Science Bites?
That's why.
Oh, no. What time? 4:30?
Oh, I'm sorry. 4:30 to 5, Tuesday afternoons.
That's right. You're cutting them to my time, dude. All right, so we go. If you tune in to 8:30 p.m., you get to spend time with me for the heart-to-heart messages. And today's show is all about Kiwanis. So I've got Dawn and Sue will be coming with me. And I'm going to see if you can guess the song and the lyrics by me reading the dedication and lyrics. Okay. To all who's helped kids around the world and share the vision that one day all children will wake up in communities that believe in them, nurture them, and provide the support they need to thrive, I dedicate these lyrics to you. With a little bit of love and a little bit of time, you can help the children of the world. Just a little bit of love and a little bit of hope. All right, can you guess the song?
Love's a many splendid things, Anna.
Wah, wrong. But you can find out if he was right, which he's not, tonight at 8:30. Where? KHOI 89.1, duh. And that's all from Anna Banana.
And, Pat, you want to just take us out?
You have been listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. Remember that you can also hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and the information you heard during the program. KHOI provides a platform for citizen and public officials to air opinions and information. The views of our guests do not necessarily reflect those of KHOI. KHOI is community, nonprofit, nonpartisan media. Live streaming of our broadcast can be found at khoifm.org.
Theme song is always backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Remember, you, the listener, what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting KHOI. And
see you again on the radio.